from the heart of Dubai, where tomorrow is being built today to the world. Welcome to the CTO Show with Mehmet. Here, we redefine technology and reimagine possibilities. With Mehmet, delve into the riveting realms of AI, cybersecurity, and digital technology. Experience the thrilling highs and lows of startups. Immerse yourself in the spirit of entrepreneurship and witness the future of business innovation being written in real time. Now, without further ado, let's tune in and explore the future.
Hello and welcome back to a new episode of the CTO Show with Mehmet. Today, I'm very pleased joining me, Colin. Colin, thank you very much for being with me on the show today. The way I love to do it is I keep it to my guests to introduce themselves because I believe it's the best way to do this. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you are up to currently.
Sure. Well, thanks, Mehmet. Really appreciate having you have me on the show, and I'm really excited to be here and really share my journey and my entrepreneurial history with you and your audience. So I've grown up in the United States, in Minnesota, the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and really kind of fell into entrepreneurship a week after I graduated from college. And it's really been an entrepreneurial journey ever since then. I really have a fondness for entrepreneurship. And I'm really looking forward to sharing that with your audience. And we can kind of go through that history however you'd like. But really excited to be here.
My absolute pleasure, Colin. The thing that I'm always, on the personal side, like even if I do this outside of the podcast, I like to ask people what attracted them to whatever they are in today. And entrepreneurship, and I know like maybe it's a cliche now, it's not the easy thing that someone might choose because, you might have the option after graduating from college, even if you are a dropout also, you might say, okay, you know what, I'm going to go and find a job in a corporate or maybe it's a family business. But choosing to be an entrepreneur, and I know that from my personal experience, is not the easiest path to do it. So, and you did it at a very young age. So tell me a little bit more about your choice, Colin, and how rewarding was this experience for you?
Yeah. Well, I can say there's probably somewhat of a recurring theme in that, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I graduated with a criminal justice degree because that allowed me to graduate in 4 years. But I was looking at other disciplines as well and ended up going with that. And a week after I graduated from college, I started my first company with no classes in business, no marketing classes, no finance classes, and really just learned it all trial by fire. And I think that experience in building something from nothing, although it's incredibly challenging, it's also very, very rewarding. I just really fell in love with the creative aspect. When you think of creativity, so often we think of, musicians and artists and things like that. But in reality, entrepreneurs are harnessing creativity at its core and are leveraging that to build businesses and products of value. And that's really what has propelled the human race forward, are creative thinkers and using entrepreneurship as a conduit for that. The other thing I think, just as it relates to the stressful components of being an entrepreneur, one of the things that's always kept me grounded is just the finiteness of our lives. Right now, if you live to the ripe old age of 90 or 100, you're pretty lucky. And I've always thought, when I'm 90 and I'm looking back on my life, I want to be able to say that I lived a life rich of experiences. And a lot of that means taking risks. And a lot of that also means failure. But that was always something to me that made some of those really hard decisions a lot easier just knowing what does my 90-year-old self want to look back on my life. And I would be a lot more, I think, appreciative and satisfied with my life if I knew that I took risks. And even if most of them failed, if some of the successes really propelled me forward, that would be a life worth living.
That's very inspiring, Colin. Now, you mentioned something which actually the question came to my mind immediately about, when you were at college, and this is, we hear it a lot, and, also I've discussed it with a couple of guests here on the show. So there are some courses which might be very good for someone to be prepared to be an entrepreneur, but, we usually, including myself, we didn't take these courses. Now, but, entrepreneurship, especially in the past, I would say maybe 30, 40 years to be fair. And, now with the ability of us being able to watch the previous entrepreneurs, don't you think that still we are missing these components in education today? Like, don't you think that, we are not teaching our kids like basic finance, basic marketing? Mm-hmm. I don't know. These things that, would help in the future for someone to be prepared to be an entrepreneur. Because, I could have asked you the question, Colin, what could have you changed in the past today? But, when you mentioned about the education, this came to my mind, right? So do you agree with me on that? And what should we do for the new generation so they can be prepared to be better entrepreneurs, I would say?
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree that, at least here in the United States, I think part of the culture in the United States certainly does have somewhat of an entrepreneurial slant, but that is generally, not something that is taught in grade school. And so I think getting younger kids and younger adults understanding the opportunity available to them through entrepreneurship is vitally important. What that requires, though, is that the school systems begin to adopt and create space for those entrepreneurial narratives, which I'm just not sure they, have the will to bring in. So what that would require, I think, would be some of us in the entrepreneurial community offering our time to go to these schools and start to talk to classes. So that's one of the things that I've done. I've gone back to my college and I've talked to some of the entrepreneurial and marketing classes there about my own experience. So I think it, some of the weight of getting these younger generations to see the opportunity in entrepreneurship falls on the current entrepreneurs to take time and share what they know.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons, and I tell people this, why I'm doing this podcast, because when I was younger, I would not say I didn't have the resources, but I didn't have someone to guide me to go and look for these resources, right? So I try to change this, giving back through this, bringing valuable guests like yourself, Colin, to talk also about their experience. Hopefully, yeah, to inspire people to, and to tell them or and guide them how they should do this properly. Now, one thing, and we were discussing this before we started recording today, I want to a little bit focus on the rise of the non-technical entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Now, till a couple of years back, a lot of people, they say, hey, I have idea, I know that this might work, I did some due diligence, I did some research, but I'm not a technical guy, so I'm not going to do it, and they get stuck. So can you, from your perspective, tell me more about this shift now in entrepreneurship and the ability for non-technical people to become entrepreneurs?
Yeah.
So how is this shift happening, and why do you think it's a game changer for, aspiring entrepreneurs today?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I'll probably just start with talking a little bit more in depth then on my entrepreneurial journey. So that first company that I started was in the mid-90s, starting, you know, we were doing direct mail and data processing. And then by 99, we started to do email marketing and web design and custom development and whatnot. I ended up selling that company in 2006. And then in 2007, I started Monkey Island Ventures with Josh and Zach, who are two of my childhood best friends. We've all known each other since we were about 5 years old. And Monkey Island's the name of a park we used to play at when we were kids. And what we wanted to do was to start building SaaS products. And the first product that we looked at building was a marketplace, which was kind of a combination of people, businesses, and nonprofits all being able to create profiles and connect with one another, share services, share products, share events, and whatnot. And so we raised money and we hired developers to help us. So Josh, Zach, and I, none of us are technical. None of us write code. We're certainly technical enough to, you know, get things done, but we don't actually write code. So we, you know, at first we used an off-the-shelf piece of software that didn't quite cut it. Then we tried using a little bit of offshore and onshore, and had good and bad experiences there, but got the product up and running, and ultimately it didn't take off, but learned some really valuable lessons there. That kind of parlayed into us building a couple of other products built on top of Twitter at the time. So this would have been around, you know, probably 2010 through 2012. One of the products we built, we again hired a developer. We took, you know, a little over a month to build the product, and within 2 days of launching the product, we signed up about 30,000 users off of Twitter. We were a trending topic on Twitter, and the product was really to help Twitter users find each other according to, this was in the United States, their zip code, and then their city and their state. And we kind of got this viral loop going. It was really great. We didn't have a monetization model, so we didn't make any money on that, unfortunately. And that parlayed into a product called SMB Tweet, which was a product that would create a Twitter following for like local retail, like coffee shops, restaurants, things like that. And that product really started to take off. We had a monetization model. We were charging $19.95 a month, and this algorithm would run, and went really, really well. Unfortunately, we had to kill the product because Twitter was changing their terms of use and didn't want any kind of automation. So we learned a hard and valuable lessons about building on top of some of these big platforms where you can achieve scale, but you're also beholden to them, and they really do control your business model. So through some of that, we launched some other tech-enabled businesses and software companies. We even created a smart water meter, and we got it funded through Kickstarter, and ended up going to Dubai for an energy conference. So we got actually flown there by Dubai to participate in this conference because of our smart water meter. But all those things being said, we were non-technical, so we were always hiring technical talent to help us build these products. During the last 7-8 years, we also created a digital marketing company and a software development company from a services-based perspective, and our software development company called Cloudburst. One of the things that we've really started to lean in on over the last few years is the use of no-code, low-code tools, as well as leveraging international development teams. And so what we built Cloudburst to be the software development company we always wished we had as non-technical entrepreneurs. And so what we're finding is that, if you look at low-code, no-code tools, they are exploding in use. It's allowing non-technical founders and entrepreneurs to begin developing products for themselves, whether they have an existing business or not. What we find, a lot of existing entrepreneurs that have successful businesses building a software product to help you scale that business is a wonderful way to grow. So you don't have to completely be technical in order to leverage some of these tools. And then with international talent, you know, you're able to leverage lower cost in getting that development done. And you're able to start to really kind of follow those lean methodologies around creating a lightweight version of your product. And then, of course, AI coming into play, that's helping developers, you know, correct code, create code more efficiently. And as we see AI more ingratiated into low code, no code products and, you know, new AI products to help you build your own products, that's going to continue to explode in use as well. So you have this kind of rise of the non-technical entrepreneur, which are all of these people where there was technical barriers holding them back. That's becoming less and less of a barrier now. And it's allowing more people, as I talked about at the beginning of you know, our talk here, which is really tapping into their own creativity, their understanding of where pain exists, and wanting to build product to help you know, solve that pain and be able to do that without having to be a technical entrepreneur. So really, it's just kind of just combination of factors that are happening now that's really, I think, going to create a thriving entrepreneurial community of non-technical entrepreneurs building tech-enabled businesses.
That's great, Colin. And you know, I'm a big fan of no-code tools. Like, of course, I come from technical background, but not coding. I was not into the coding. Okay, I can understand codes, but I cannot write like a application. And you know, when the first time I've seen the first no-code tool a couple of years back, you know, I said, actually, even I remember during my studies, you know, they used to teach us the basic, you know, programming languages and, you know, trying to do something visual. And I always was thinking this should be much easier. Like even for someone who's, you know, I'm a computer engineer graduate. Even I was saying there must be a simpler way to do this. It doesn't have to be that complex. And, you know, I was always looking for things that can generate code. And then I started to see the no-code tools. And then I said, oh, wow, like this is exactly what I was thinking about when 20 years back when I was still studying. So to your point, it's absolutely, you know, something that is enabling people to get their ideas out to life. Now, of course, but there are the naysayers all the time. You know, the people that say, you know, they try to put the stick in the wheels, as we say. Now, and one of the things that they say, hey, but, you know, you cannot go beyond an MVP. You cannot scale, you know, using no-code tools and so on. From your experience, what you can tell us, Colin, about this point specifically, because, you know, the aim here today is to encourage people to go forward and not to listen. But of course, from someone who has experience, it would have like more authority, I would say. So tell me a little bit more about what you say about these opinions about the scaling and, you know, the limitations that low-code tools have.
Yeah, there definitely is, you know, scaling and limitations with low-code, no-code. So you may be able to get a product 70, 80% of the way there with low-code, no-code. You may need to hire development talent in order to help you kind of close that loop on how your product operates in order to give the experience that you want to give to your prospects and your customers. With that being said, you know, one of the things we talk about is it's never been easier to build software. It's also never been easier to overbuild a product. And so I think that's one of the things, especially at Cloudburst, one of the things that we kind of act as is kind of this guide or this mentor layer, because a lot of our clients, because they are non-technical and they don't really understand software, they don't know how to hold the technical talent you know, within you know, a layer of you know, being able to tell them, you know, how things should be done or not, right? So they're missing that component. They can't write the code. They can't tell the developer if their code's any good. They can't tell the developer how long things should take. So they're kind of stuck in this difficult spot of having to manage technical talent when they don't really understand the technical aspects of what it takes to build. So my suggestion is that, you know, you have a very narrow focus on what it is that you want to accomplish with what you're trying to build. Look at low-code, no-code solutions as a way to potentially cobble something together. You may need to hire some development talent to help you, like I said, finalize the product for release. But at the same time, as we know, so often, if you're really addressing a real pain point, then you need to realize that you don't have to have a beautiful product. You don't have to have a product that is, perfected. What you need to have is a product that is addressing that pain that user is feeling enough to where they want to use your product. And, I recall, Zapier was listening to was at a conference last year and was listening to him talking about, the CEO talking about the launch of Zapier in the very, very early days. And he had a brand new user, one of their first users ever, that created like this long Zap. And he was walking through trying to figure out with the customer why it wasn't working. And he finally got to the end and they fixed it. And in his mind, he was thinking, wow, this Zapier product is horrible. Like, I don't know why people are even using it. He felt really embarrassed. But his customer said at the end of that, wow, this is fantastic. Like, I can't believe that we're going to be able to automate this. You're helping me so much. You're reducing this pain for me. It's going to save me, at least a couple hours a week. So I think as entrepreneurs, we need to understand, keeping our vision very, very focused and very thin around what is that pain that we're trying to solve and really attacking that strongly, getting it out into the hands of users when you're, still building it and feeling probably somewhat uncomfortable about the polish on the product. But to me, that would be my big recommendation is that, yes, low-code, no-code tools aren't perfect. Can they solve the pain enough to where you could start to test it out? If not, and you need a little bit more development talent on the back end, then you should be able to cobble, something together that's helping you save money and get that kind of first version out into the hands of prospects so you can start to get feedback. And, the Y Combinator said one of the biggest indicators of success for building software is how fast you can iterate. So that's what I would really be focusing on is you're going to run into issues and problems, but how fast can you work through those is really a key factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, I'm a big advocate actually for these tools. I know, of course, we know the limitations.
Yep.
But as someone who tries to help founders mainly, I talk a lot about idea validation. And
yes.
When you want to do idea validation, of course, the minimal viable product is what comes to mind. And there's no better, I would say, tool today like these no-code, low-code tools that allow founders to, build things really fast. I did some tests last year, and I was trying to come up with little bit hard ideas, not the easy ones, not like, for example, directories or lists. I was trying to do something I would not say very complex, but a little bit more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because, I had the hands-on experience. It took me less than 24 hours to figure it out. But I thought if someone open YouTube, watch some videos, maybe to watch how Zapier works or the other tools for automation, how some of the no-code tools Bubble, Softr, all these tools, Webflow. I thought someone can sit in a weekend, watch some videos and start to, get their hands dirty, as they say. And probably it would take them, I believe, 1 to 2 weeks and they can have a product.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about that, because I was thinking always from a techie guy perspective, I said, if instead as a non-technical founder, if I want to go to a developer and tell him my vision, I might struggle because I cannot translate what I'm trying to do. But if I go and show them, hey, this is what I want to build, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the prototype I built. Make it for me scalable, make it for me secure, make it for me. So, yeah, absolutely. Now, Colin, I want you know, to ask you about two things which you talked about. So first one is the idea. So in your opinion, what makes an idea really worth to try to build it? And especially from a non-technical founder perspective. And you mentioned a couple of things you tried to do before. You had to kill some products and you had to continue with some. Of course, I can understand, you know, the limitations, but what makes an idea really worth to validate, in your opinion?
Yeah. So I think the number one thing is that, you know, hopefully it's an idea that you're at minimum interested in, at, you know, maximum that you're really passionate about solving. As you and I know, it's very difficult to build a business. It's very difficult to get a product to scale. So you're going to have to really have the fortitude to work through all of the different issues that you're going to run into. So that's number one, is hopefully you're interested and passionate about the idea. If it's something that you feel like, you know what, I can make money at this, I have a really good line of sight on how to build it, and yes, I'm interested in it, I'm not passionate about it, but I think this is a business that could really work, and you know, I have an exit strategy of, you know, maybe selling the business in, you know, 3 to 5 years, whatever, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to go after something where you think there's an opportunity to really build a business. So you know, that's the first thing. You know, I remember listening to Guy Kawasaki many years ago, and he says, you know, don't listen to the bozos. And a big part of that is, you know, if you have an idea and it's something that you're interested in pursuing, don't worry about what other people say that are shooting it down if it's something that you truly believe in. With that being said, I think one of the things you want to start to do is get some feedback or some data points around the idea. So a couple of things there. Number one, you know, I would recommend thinking about talking to your prospects. You want to do it in a way that is not even giving them an indicator that maybe you're trying to build a product, but you're really trying to understand how they are either running their lives or running their work in ways that give you an understanding of what it is that you should be building more specifically. So there's this book, The Mom Test, which I read, which does a really nice job talking about how to talk to prospects without telling them what it is that you're building. Because if you go out and you tell people, hey, like what we did with our very first product, which was called Buy the Change, we're like, hey, we're going to build this, you know, online marketplace where you can do all of these things. Does that sound like a good idea? Well, we got tons of people saying, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, I'd use that for sure. And then we launch and it's just crickets. None of those people are using it at all. So, if you got to be really wary about your idea if you're just going and telling people about it, because most of your ideas will probably sound pretty good to people, but most of them probably won't actually act on it. So, you know, from an idea perspective, you want to have interest or passion around it, make sure that it's something you can make money at. Number two, you know, you want to engage with your prospects in ways that are helping you understand, you know, their pain and how your product can address that pain. And then, you know, I think another thing that you can do in trying to validate the idea, and I've done this numerous times, which is you can set up landing pages with the idea and, you know, have an email like subscribe link or whatnot for when the beta goes live, and then start going out. And so I've run campaigns on LinkedIn, you know, cold email, and have gotten, you know, thousands of people to sign up for the different products that we've launched or that we've launched with our clients. And getting that initial audience of interested users is a really great way to, you know, actually launch your MVP when you're ready to launch. But it's also a good indicator on, do people even care about what it is that you're looking to build? So creating a landing page with copy and calls to action and then going out to your target market even before you've built anything is a great way to start getting that audience, your target audience, to start giving you at least some data validation that they're interested. And you could even reach out then to some of that audience and see how many would be open to just talk for, you know, 10, 20 minutes about your idea, or about their pain, more importantly. So that's what I would say around idea validation is, kind of, you know, following, you know, like I said, hopefully you have interest and passion. Number two, hopefully you can get into conversation with some of your prospects around their pain, without divulging necessarily what it is that you're building. And then number three, you can build landing page and start driving traffic from your targeted audience to that page and see if they'll actually sign up, and then even have conversations with some of those people, after they've signed up, and see if they'll talk about, their pain and, you know, potentially your product.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always, when I talk to people about, they say, hey, how we can validate our ideas? I give them a lot of examples, of course, of many companies that they did it the right way. And what you just mentioned, the landing page with the call to action, you know, collect the emails. Hey, like, tell me when this is ready, or, you know, we are launching soon. Get notified when we are out in public. Another way, I give the example of Dropbox and their famous, you know, they even recorded the, you know, the video before even having the product, mm-hmm. but they find out that, you know, there's a high demand on what they were trying to do at that time. So absolutely. Now, shifting a little bit gears here, Colin, and, you know, of course, sometimes in this entrepreneurial journey, we need to have some funding, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, all the time, and every single guest on the show, when I ask them, we preferred, you know, when I say we, me and my guests, like, it depends, of course, what they are trying to do. It depends. I know that it depends. But of course, you know, bootstrapping first. But at some stage, you're going to scale the business somehow, or you're mm-hmm. gonna need some more resources either to build or to go out and, you know, do marketing and whatever. So, and when I was researching, I found that you came up with the shared success agreement as mm-hmm. another concept to traditional funding methods. So tell me about this, and what was the inspiration behind the shared success agreement?
Yeah, no, that's great. So so again, I'll take you back with a story. So when we were building that product, SMB Tweet, which was that Twitter product that would grow a Twitter following for small businesses, the developer that we hired said to us, look, I know you guys are in bootstrap mode. He says, my normal rate is $100 an hour, but I'll charge you $50 an hour to build the MVP. But once the MVP is built and launched, I want 10% of your revenue to go back to me and pay me out at $150 an hour until I'm paid out on all the hours that I put in to build the MVP. And we said, okay, that sounds like a good deal. So we paid him $50 an hour, and he got paid to build the MVP, which he was satisfied with. We got our MVP, and we started to generate revenue, and he ended up then getting paid out at $150 an hour. So he got an additional income stream coming in, and he didn't have to put in any more work. And he was really happy about that. And we got our MVP built, and we didn't have to give up any equity. And so that was really the kind of the kernel of the idea for creating the shared success agreement. And so when we started Cloudburst as a software development company, we wanted to offer shared success to some of the clients that we worked with, and it's worked out, you know, phenomenally well. Really, we see shared success as being an alternative to debt or equity or crowdfunding. Shared success is very lightweight. You don't have to worry about cap tables and evaluating, you know, the business, and you know, there's a lot less hoops that you have to jump through. So, but you also have to understand that when you create a shared success agreement, the founder is not incurring debt. So it's not a guarantee that money has to be paid out. So, you know, as the service provider, as you know, if you're discounting your services for a share of future revenue, you know, you're really kind of banking on that this founder entrepreneur, that their business is going to continue to generate revenue if they are already an existing business, or that they will generate revenue if they're net new. But it is a wonderful way to get in partnership with each other. And so kind of the basic premise, and we actually created a website called sharedsuccessagreement.org, where anyone can go and create these shared success agreements for free. We don't make any money on it. And the shared, there's a calculator built into it, where you can play around with different numbers around, you know, how big is the, you know, the project or the investment, you know, what percentage of that is going to be shared success and what percentage is going to be maybe your normal rate. And then of the percentage that is going to shared success, what kind of a multiple would you want on it? So, you know, maybe the project is $10,000. $5,000 you're going to get paid your normal rate. $5,000 is going to be shared success. Maybe you want a 3x multiple on that $5,000. So that's really going to turn into $15,000 that the entrepreneur needs to pay you back. And then you're able to decide, you know, kind of over what period of time you think that might happen. And then the calculator will actually show you what your return would be, you know, if you're providing services through a shared success agreement. So a founder or entrepreneur or a service, you know, provider can both, you know, utilize this calculator and see what how the numbers come out. You can also give money through a shared success agreement, and you don't have to be an accredited investor. So a shared success agreement is also opening up the opportunity for founders to get money through a shared success agreement instead of having to get money through equity or debt. So there's a lot of value there as well for the entrepreneur. So I highly encourage anyone that's looking at funding to also look at sharedsuccessagreement.org as a way to look at getting funding in a very founder-friendly way. And then when you play around with the calculator, when you're done, again, there's only like five or six fields. When you submit kind of this form on it, you'll get emailed the shared success agreement in a Word document with kind of a bunch of the legalese that's in it. And then you just need to fine tune the agreement between you and the other party. But it's just a really a great way for you know, founders and entrepreneurs to get in real kind of win-win arrangements with service providers or funders, people giving them money.
That's a very interesting way of doing it. Now, I'm not sure, you know, like this is to me looks like a win-win for everyone, right? So, you know, and there's no risk also as well. I believe such concept needs some time to for at least in the region where I'm living. But the other day I was talking to a friend and he found someone actually, it's not like they don't do it this way. So they build the MVP, they don't charge money until, you know, they can tick all the boxes that they were agreed on before. So there is an agreement. It's not like a shared revenue agreement. Mm-hmm. So if they don't tick all the boxes, they don't ask for the money. And then after that, when everyone say, hey, yes, we can sign this off, so then they will pay them whatever rate that they agreed on. But your concept is more, you know, towards people who, you know, they want to build it in a proper way faster, I would say. And then, you know, it probably would let them skip, I would say, maybe the angel round, kind of, if I'm correct, Colin. Is that right?
To skip the what, did you say?
The angel round, you know, like if looking for angel investors. Usually, you know, so the phase where they say, hey, I have this concept. I'm still in a pre-seed phase. I have the idea on paper. I validated it, but I need someone to build it for me, right?
Yeah. Yep. No, I think, you know, it's really those kind of the pre-seed round where you're looking to get enough traction on the product where you could have a shared success agreement in place because once you actually start to take on investors that are wanting equity, what you'll find is they're going to want to see like a cap table. They're going to want to understand, how your business is structured legally. But the beautiful thing, again, about a shared success agreement is that you don't, you're not affecting the cap table. You're not affecting anything. And so doesn't mean that you still need to pay the funder or the service provider back if you're the entrepreneur. So each month you're supposed to record your revenue, and then whatever percentage of that revenue needs to go back to pay back whoever has helped you, build or fund your product. So certainly you still have some responsibilities, but it's in a much more lightened way where you're not having to deal with a bunch of legal.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And yeah, like this is something also repeated on the show. So you really need to go for funding when, you are in a probably advanced stage. So when you you have the business, you don't want to give a lot of equity, because a lot of things that I figured out recently, which I thought it's common sense, first time founders, they get shocked to know when, they get to know that they're going to lose equity more on the long run, because probably the first round they're going to give 20%, and then they're going to give 10%, and then they end up by keeping 9% or so at the end, when they're going to exit, right? So it's absolutely to try. I'm not saying to avoid. Of course, at some stage, if you are going to have this, massive big product, which would be a global product, of course you need to have funding from VCs and private equity maybe. But yeah, so as long as you can delay this, the better it is, just to avoid the dilution.
I was just going to say there's a whole, kind of with this rise of the non-technical entrepreneur, there's also just this rise of bootstrapper businesses where they're profitable businesses, they're growing well, and they don't need to take funding. So funding doesn't always have to be, where you're giving up equity. That doesn't always have to be a path. The biggest thing that you want to do is build a business that is solving a pain, where you're able to grow and you're able to scale. And if you're able to do that, you're also reducing risk in the eyes of investors, which gives you the power. And so what you want to do is ensure that you're at each stage reducing risk in the eyes of whoever may be investing in you. So that's what I would encourage anybody listening that's an entrepreneur, is reduce that risk. That puts you in a position of power, and that will allow you a lot more flexibility in how you want to grow your business.
Absolutely. Now, as we are coming almost to an end, Colin, after all these experiences that you have, and I believe, I wish I could have some same story. Like you've always been an entrepreneur and you created great products and companies. So if you want to, leave the audience today with final, I would say, advice and final words of wisdom, if you want to talk it this way, what you would tell them?
Yeah, a few things. For me, having business partners has been an absolutely wonderful thing. Being an entrepreneur is not an easy path, and if you do it alone, it can also be a very lonely path. So I feel very fortunate to have two business partners where, we put our friendship and our families ahead of the business. And that's allowed us to have been in business together for over 15 years now. And so I would highly encourage, if you can find business partners that, you trust and that could really enhance your entrepreneurial journey, take a hard look at that. The other thing is, if you're building businesses in areas that you just love and enjoy, that is another wonderful avenue and path to take, because that, during those tough times of being an entrepreneur, that just enjoying the work, or at least enjoying the industry that you're in, makes that hard work just that much easier. So I would highly encourage you to focus in on areas that you have interest and passion around. The other thing I would say is, pay attention to your natural gifts. Like, what are you good at? What maybe comes a little bit easier to you? What do you enjoy? If you are non-technical and you're trying to learn code and it's incredibly difficult, but you have talents in marketing or branding or building a community, focus in on the areas that you're good at and do that, and then fill in the gaps of other people helping you out. So that would be the other thing. And then I would also say, try and get validation on the product. Really, I would highly encourage you to go after the bootstrapper path. There's tons of communities. There's tons of resources for you to learn, how to get started. And the last thing I'll say too, especially for those entrepreneurs that have existing businesses, there's really never been a better time to build software to scale a business. And so I would take a kind of a really hard look at your opportunities as an entrepreneur that already has an existing business and how you can create value. One of the things we just talk about for as an entrepreneur wanting to scale with software is, number one, have a vision for what you want to build. Number two, get the MVP built and get it in the hands of your team and or your customers. Number three, if you're able to get usage and good feedback from your internal team and customers that this is a product that they value, you can start then in stage three using this product as a differentiator as you go to market. And as you are talking to prospects, you can say, look, we have this product, none of our competitors have it, and it's giving this type of a wonderful experience or this type of result. So that's stage three, is helping you close business with your software. Stage four is, if you can prove that your business is scaling with software, now you've added a multiple to the value of your business. Investors or people that might want to buy the business are going to see a lot more value in your business if you have something that is proprietary, that's helping you scale, that your competitors don't have. Now you've created a multiple to the value of your business. A lot of entrepreneurs may stop at stage four, but some entrepreneurs will want to jump to the final stage, which is stage five, which is, if you have created software that is addressing this pain for your company in your industry, it's very likely that other companies in your industry would also want this software. So launching your product as a SaaS product is a wonderful way to truly scale in ways that you just can't do with people, because with SaaS, you're scaling with tech. So that final stage five is releasing your product as a SaaS product into the industry. So that's what I would say for kind of thinking about like the stage of your business and how you can grow with software. That's a wonderful way to think about it.
I would really say these are great. I never thought about these five stages. So that was very enlightening, I would say, Colin. Thank you very much for sharing this. Final thing, where people can find more about you and learn about your company?
That's great. So you can find me on LinkedIn at Colin Herdman, H-I-R-D-M-A-N, and connect with me there. I love connecting with other entrepreneurs around the world. You can also find me at cloudburststudio.com. We have a Clarity Canvas, which is a free 1.5-hour workshop for entrepreneurs to talk through their software if you have an idea that you want to discuss. MonkeyIslandVentures.com is the site that talks more about kind of our umbrella company and just the different companies that we have and the investments that we've made and things like that.
Great. I will make sure that all these websites and links are in the show notes. Sure. At the end, Colin, really, I appreciate the time today. A lot of valuable insights and your long experience, of course, in the domain of entrepreneurship. I'm sure that the audience would benefit out of it. So thank you very much for sharing that with us today. And this is how I end usually my episodes. So this is for the audience. If you just discovered this podcast by luck, thank you for passing by. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did so, please subscribe and share it with your friends and colleagues. And if you are one of the loyal followers and loyal audience, thank you very much for keep sending me all your notes, all your remarks, all your comments and suggestions. Please let them keep coming. I really appreciate that. And if you are an entrepreneur, wherever you are in the world, you have an idea, you want to share it with the rest of the world, don't hesitate to reach out to me. This is why the show exists. If you have even something which is you think no one would care about, we can discuss that. If you know there is a match, of course we can record an episode together and make it out to the world. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'll meet again very soon. Thank you. Bye-bye. Hit that subscribe.